And welcome back to the Critic Podcast. Back for another of our weekly conversations between me, contributing editor Ben Sixsmith, and my esteemed colleague, online editor Sebastian Milbank. Sebastian, how are you today?
Sleepy. I'd like to say I was glued to the American midterms, but no, I was just out late night last night drinking.
Which I think is eminently the better option.
It because was definitely the better option.
What better thing to do when you wake up with a hangover than to look at the midterm election results? And what did you think? The Red Ripple, absolutely, as we're titling this episode. What do you think of the results, Sebastian? I'm feeling rather stupid. I expected a tremendous tidal wave of red, and the results have been definitely underwhelming.
Okay, American midterms are one of the stupidest electoral events imaginable. I mean, where do we sum this up? Basically, first of all, just as the parliamentary system goes, they get elected every 2 years, so they re-elect Congress halfway through a presidential term, which basically means that basically means they're constantly campaigning and they sink whatever agenda they had going halfway through. The other effect to this, of course, is that nobody very much cares compared to presidential elections. The turnout's always abysmal. That people often use them to file a protest vote, which again is a fairly disastrous system. And again, because their turnout's quite low. And bear in mind, we're talking about like a red wave, but why are we all so shocked? Why has it all gone wrong? Well, because it was within the margin of error, because a lot of these seats were going to be flipped by 1 or 2 percentage points. And I mean, there are more knowledgeable people than I about American electoral politics, but if I had to level a guess, I would say that probably the red wave narrative itself hurt turnout. So it would have been, it probably motivated Democratic voters to go out there and stop it.
Thank God we just have by-elections. No, I think there's something to that. The prospect of Trump looming in the future, I'm sure, energized Democratic voters as well. And the kind of fear in the media of a Republican tidal wave just sweeping democracy off the American political landscape forever. I do think there are some kind of structural problems with the Republican Party which hurt them as well. One of them is just the quality of their candidates. I don't know why the quack doctor from Oprah was thrust into a candidacy position. I think possibly one of the only men in America who could have lost to an ailing candidate like John Fetterman. Perhaps one thing that's relevant to us as British conservatives of various stripes, I've seen online a lot of chatter about how perhaps the end of Roe v. Wade served to both energize Democrats and to inspire independents to turn against the Republican Party. Do you think this says anything for social conservatism in the US and possibly even in Europe?
No. Very little. I mean, I think it probably helped with turnout. It probably helped them stay in the midterms. But I mean, this is not a blue wave either. I mean, the evidence is that, you know, stuff like the Kentucky abortion ban not going through. You know, I think this is an example. In fact, when you turn things back to the states, you do actually end up with more centrist results than pro-choice people have been claiming. So I think this idea that we're going to have lots of very extreme state situations has not really been carried out, because it turns out there are lots of Democrats in red states and lots of Republicans in blue states.
That's true. We shouldn't have this kind of bipolar attitude where because there wasn't a red wave, we think the opposite has transpired. Actually, it's probably to a more informed and neutral observer, it might end up being the kind of grim, dull, predictable result that could have been foreseen. But there's another question here, which is why are we even discussing this? There's a high probability that we won't be doing a podcast for German elections, for French elections, for Italian elections, God knows, for Polish elections.
I thought they had
German
some,
elections.
I thought they had some kind of Kaiser. Is that the case anymore? They're electing people now.
No, I hear they've moved backwards since those times. But yeah. Why do you think we have this fixation with American politics?
I mean, part of it is just that they speak the same language. And that's the sort of simple, boring answer. I mean, the more involved answer is that America is just a kind of global hegemon. And we're sort of on the periphery of a sort of modern 21st century empire. And I think it's important to not think of, and I think we're so often like, oh no, America, it's a country. No, it's 300 million people with the world's largest, you know, well, the world's most powerful military, the largest economy. You know, this is a kind of empire. It's, you know, it's a modern commercial military empire that isn't territorial outside of the United States, but it's certainly, you know, they've got military bases all over the world. The reason we care about American elections is because, depending on who they elect, that could affect the entirety of the future of the world. So there's a degree to which it's easy to say we're too obsessed with it, and I do agree with that, but we should also put it in perspective. When we choose the American president, we do choose the person who's going to lead the entire Western alliance, so that it's not... I think the where it gets a bit more... I think where the question becomes more involved is, well, why do we care about the midterms? You know, that it's not just that we care about who the president is. It's that we seem to care about the minutiae. And I think where it goes from being a healthy interest in who governs the world empire to being an unhealthy kind of fixation on US internal politics is we seem to define our own politics in American terms now. You know, you've got people cheering on the Democrats or, you know, cheering on the Republicans and sort of hoping for one outcome over the other, not because of what they're going to do in terms of, like, you know, trade deals or something, not from a self-interest perspective, but because they genuinely identify with US political factions and often without really understanding the underlying forces.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we can't wish Americanization away. It's not a media class phenomenon. It's a media phenomenon in as much as American culture spreads throughout TV, it spreads throughout social media, but it's also an economic phenomenon. It's a military phenomenon. But I agree that doesn't mean that every aspect of American politics is relevant to that Americanization. If John Fetterman triumphs over Dr. Oz, that doesn't necessarily mean anything for a European.
Yeah, I'm not really sure what's going on there. It seems like somebody off reality TV or something is running against Shrek. And I'm glad Shrek won for what that was. That's worth. I'm sure he'll do a better job. Speaking of candidates, I mean, I think probably the positive spin that the right would put on it is that they've had two very strong presidential candidates. In Marco Rubio and Ron DeSantis, they both had good performances in the midterms. I mean, particularly Ron DeSantis is very much sort of being picked, you know, the governor of Florida. You know, he won by landslide, and, you know, Florida is very much a swing state. And that's I think the New York Post was running with that. You know, I mean, this is very, I think Ron DeSantis is very likely as a next presidential candidate.
Yeah, there's certainly something to that. I mean, Rubio has lost before. Yeah. He does kind of cling on to a prominent position in US political life, but it's hard to come back from failure against a candidate who is already possibly in the running. We'll see if Donald Trump does announce his candidacy. It seems probable. Of course, nobody has ever captured the fascination and, I guess, horror of European and otherwise international observers like Donald Trump. Do you see him running against DeSantis from where you sit?
Yeah, it's a question of whether either of them want to run against each other, whether Trump will run. Everyone's talking about it. I mean, a lot of people have been interpreting this election as a defeat for Trumpism, because they point out that, you know, a lot of traditional Republicans have done fairly well. A lot of Trump's picks, such as, God help us, Dr. Ross, did not do so well. I think that, again, like, you're talking very small margins. I think people are reading, far too much into it, and also very much the wrong thing. So if I was to actually, you know, do what I've condemned and draw a parallel between British politics and American politics, I'd say that conservatism both on both sides of the pond is currently in this situation where they've drawn all the wrong lessons from populism and from candidates like Trump. So you've seen, you know, a lot of centrist candidates have been making noises about culture war issues. You know, they've been talking about, you know, trans issues. They've been talking about immigration. They've been talking about defeating wokeism and about free speech. And I think they genuinely believe that that's what got Trump into power. And if they do it enough, if they talk about, like, you know, and promise tax cuts, they will win. And I mean, that's clearly not happened. But it's not that they've been defeated, but they haven't got anything like the kind of Trumpian surge in interest and support, and the base hasn't turned out for them. And I think the reason, and you know, you see something similar in Britain where, you know, you've seen all, you know, like the Conservative leadership contest was just full, you know, of people trying to sort of be the most culture war-y, and it felt completely artificial. And I think what the reason that Trump was so successful, and the reason he was able to defy all the odds and take power and still proves incredibly popular with a lot of Republicans, is that there's the stuff that we all seem to forget or choose to forget about him, which is that he's someone who condemned the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. He's an enemy of neoconservatism. He's someone who spoke up for economic protectionism, who condemned globalization. Instead, he's someone who's actually very good at, I mean, not at acting, but it's certainly about talking about standing up for ordinary people, you know, trying to kind of do something to better people's circumstances, promising to transform people's lives. I think that kind of transformative promise is something that we haven't really seen from Republican candidates, who mostly just kind of think they're being Trumpian just by being negative. And I think because we focus so much on the negative Trump, understandably, we forget that the reason the negative worked for him is because people felt he was on their side. And so that's when he was condemning people, they felt that he was standing up for them. And that's true. You know, for example, I think I'd have to look at the figures again, but I think this current electorate, if you compare it to the Trump electorate, this midterms, again, it's a much whiter electorate. You know, white suburban voters have turned out, broadly speaking, for Republicans, but a lot of the kind of the Trump coalition, which had more, again, you've got to remember, he did better than Romney amongst Black voters, amongst Latin American voters. And that factor, and again, a lot of this was basically about class. He could speak to working class voters. And those are the people who didn't turn out in these midterms. And that's no doubt made the difference.
That's true. Just on a more superficial level as well, it might seem like blasphemy to invoke the great men of history theory in the context of Donald Trump, but just as a personality, he is truly exceptional. The level of charisma, and I don't quite want to say wit, but just humor.
He was witty. The man was an entertainer. Again, bear in mind, he was on TV for a living.
Absolutely.
He's extremely witty.
I can't believe there's anyone who can think of that great Ron DeSantis quote, you know, that iconic Ron DeSantis moment. And even someone who would curse Donald Trump to the deepest bowels of hell can think of just 10 hilarious moments from his time as a candidate and his time in office. So that's going to be a big stumbling block, not just for a candidate like Rubio or DeSantis to overcome, but any candidate across the world who has pretensions towards being that kind of populist iconoclast.
Yeah, I mean, and if you look at, like, you know, what are the kind of these big kind of gubernatorial wins for the Republicans post-Trump? You know, it's been Youngkin in Virginia, you know, bringing, you know, that's a purple state turning increasingly blue. You know, he managed to pull it back to red. It's a similar story in Florida with DeSantis. And again, in both cases, it was over COVID. There was a huge amount of economic damage done by lockdowns. They were by kind of charting a more sensible course over lockdowns, by promising to keep protect industry and keep businesses open, not ruin people's livelihoods. They won huge support in their states. But again, I think it's really important to understand that why they're so popular is because they were able to deliver for voters economically. So COVID, it wasn't, you know, maybe it's, you can frame it. And then of course they do as a cultural issue, but really this was a livelihood issue. This was a money in the pocket issue. And unless they can make a similar kind of economic case now, post-COVID, post-lockdown, for why they should be in power, I don't think like the DeSantis effect is going to, in Florida, is going to translate into national politics. And I think the real fear is that DeSantis will just say, try and play the cultural game. He'll try and play the libertarian game. I stand up for personal freedom and low taxes and guns. And, you know, I don't think that America at the moment, dealing with problems it is really going to go for that.
That's true. People care about the culture war stuff. They care about crime. They care about geopolitics. But ultimately, people care first and foremost about how heavy their pockets are, rightly or wrongly. And if you can't fill those pockets and you don't have, you know, clear promises for filling those pockets, you're just not going to prevail.
You've got to fill a pocket or two.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, of course, we'll see as soon the candidates will announce themselves, we'll see how the race is going to shape up. But you were talking earlier about how the midterms don't have any of the transformative effects that the presidential elections arguably have on the rest of the world. Do you think they're going to have any influence, for example, on American policy towards Ukraine would be one possible case, or just a kind of broader cultural impact across the world? Do you think there's going to be any kind of international consequences coming out of these elections?
No. Again, I'm saying no a lot, but yeah, it's just I think if there'd been some huge decisive wave one way or the other, maybe there would have been. But first of all, I don't think in terms of foreign policy there's much division at the moment in a meaningful sense. Everyone supports Ukraine. Everyone supports a hard line against Russia. There's not a lot of meaningful dissent from that in Congress. I mean, the more interesting question would be if there was some kind of huge populist surge that might have an impact, you know, in other countries. I mean, but that hasn't happened. So, but nor has populism been defeated or anything in some huge symbolic battle. So I don't think this is going to make any difference whatsoever to anything.
As the battle, the race for nomination for the White House heats up, would your advice to Britons and to Europeans be to largely ignore it? You know, until the election, should we obsess ourselves with who's going to be the Republican candidate, you know, with whether Biden is going to run again for the White House, or is this just a big waste of time and energy?
Well, I think it sort of speaks to a deep question of how the British media report stories and how they report foreign affairs. And I think there's a big problem that when they go to, first of all, they severely underreport European politics. That's our neighbours, our main economic trade partners. Mm-hmm. Their EU policy has a direct impact on Britain still. So these are things that we should care about and we need to know about. Now, obviously, America is also an important country, an important partner. So, again, it's important we know what's going on in America. But I think the problem is that when British reporters go to most countries, they come saying, you know, what are the implications for Brits, whether traveling abroad or foreign policy? Whereas when they go to America, it's like, what are the implications for Americans? And I was like, well, we're not Americans. We need to know the way we report American politics. Let's park the question of the extent to which we cover it for a moment. You know, the way we report it needs to be, how does this affect Britain? That needs to be the framing. And I think if the answer to that is, well, it doesn't, then maybe that's our answer to the extent to which it was reported as well. I'm not saying we should just be purely, you know, narrow. It's like, it's good to know what's going on in other countries. But I think that's kind of, you know, it's not even just a language question. I did raise that earlier. I mean, if you look, we don't report in Canada or Australia in the same way, even though lots of Brits live in Canada and Australia. So, you know, like, or have family there. So we're not really reporting in a responsible, intelligent way.
Yeah, I think American politics can become this kind of grand soap opera that we immerse ourselves in, and where we kind of pick our sides. British rightists might support the Republican candidate and British leftists might support the Democrat candidate. But it's just kind of, it's mere tribalism and mere entertainment. And that is a temptation that is worth resisting in ourselves, even if it's a temptation we must admit that we feel as well. I wonder if Americans ever immerse themselves in our politics in the same way. Do you think there are many Texans and Oklahomans and New Yorkers who follow our by-elections and think, God, I wonder if the Tories are going to prevail in New Rutlandshire?
They should. If only they did, we'd all be better off. But yeah, I think the new stuff is very annoying and it's symptomatic, but I think the bigger problem becomes the cultural hegemony as well. You know, when we wear American clothes, we listen to American music, we consume American TV, we're consuming the culture of a country we don't really fully understand. You know, so it's like, I think the version of America a lot of people consume and buy is not the real America. So I mean, what we end up with is this kind of synthetic ersatz global culture that's kind of sourced out of America. And we don't kind of have a strong connection to our own traditional culture, but then neither are we really getting the best of America or really understanding them. And I think like the way we report American politics, you know, so many people are like, oh, those crazy Americans with their guns and their religion and like, aren't they weird? And it's sort of almost anthropological. It's different enough just to be entertaining, but we don't really get everything out of it politically, intellectually.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm sure it's would sound alien to any American when, you know, there are people who think the Westboro Baptist Church has like a million members and whatever happens in Portland is being played out across, you know, street battles from everywhere from Maine to Alabama. Because we do have this kind of farcical sense of what it means to be in America, even if sometimes it sounds great fun.
I mean, Ben, do you think there's a sort of sense of which we sort of have an imagined version of like the Republican, what the Republican Party believes and what the Democratic Party believes? I mean, there's a lot of British people, even on the right, identify with the Democratic Party. And I'm not really sure they understand what it's really like, what they really believe in.
Yeah, I think that a lot of kind of liberal conservatives have the sense of Democrats as just being the grown-ups, to use a favoured phrase of Westminster hacks, just being kind of smooth and moderate and competent, as if they've just walked out of the West Wing, and just this kind of managerial attitude towards life where they might not be exciting. We might not always agree with them, but they kind of know what has to be done, whereas Republicans are just these kind of comedy ogres lurching around, insisting that they should be able to eat guns and fire hamburgers all the time. And obviously leftists believe that to an even greater extent. And God knows that there are glimpses of truth in that. I'm certainly not trying to suggest that the Republicans don't have these kind of farcical and thuggish elements in the party. But it is a very crude understanding of American politics. And I think sometimes, especially on cultural issues, Europeans don't appreciate how much more extreme the Democrats can be than their left-wing or liberal leaders. So it is a very strange perspective that people can have on American politics.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always struck by the way that you see people on the left really lionizing Democratic leaders. I mean, you know, I think particularly the sheer number of people who are very obsessively keen on Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton. And, you know, you see a lot of write-ups in The Guardian or The Independent, you know, sort of really kind of just pouring on the sugar. And I sort of think to myself, these are the same people who say we need to decolonize the curriculum, or we need to sort of deal with kind of like problematic racial hierarchies in British society. And it's like, these are people who are ordering drone strikes on, you know, Black and Middle Eastern people by the tens of thousands. Like, you know, they're running a global empire at which white Americans are at the top. And I continue to find it, like, you know, I'm not saying, of course, there are lots of people on the left who are very anti-NATO and anti-American, and those people are out there. But the number of people on the centre-left who kind of seem to sort of superficially buy into an anti-imperialist rhetoric, but then are obsessed, you know, with you know, the people, you know, and again, like the American, you know, the US Democratic Party is probably more pro-American empire than the Republican Party, certainly under Trump. You know, Trump was basically America first, more isolationist, you know, whereas the Democratic Party's instincts are much more interventionist.
Yeah, so that's true. I think
the left is not more pragmatic about that issue.
I think the left and also elements of the center-right have this idea that given that America is a republic, that makes it much more meritocratic, and their leaders have a kind of stature, also helped by the fact that they are a superpower. Their leaders have this kind of stature that ours wouldn't, because we're more traditional society, we're a monarchy, and they don't realize the level of glad-handing and machineering that goes into American politics. I mean, God knows Hillary Clinton is, for all of her undoubted talents in politicking, she is a former first lady. So they look for these great figures in the world, and they find these glossy non-entities in American life and just want to elevate them to the stature of great figures in the past, even if that doesn't really align with their actual abilities and their actual actions in the world. And that comes back to this sense of America as just being a more glamorous and more important place. There's of course, there's a long tradition of British journalists kind of graduating to America on the right and the left. It's kind of almost a symbol of making it. If you can leave London and go to New York or Washington. So it is this kind of starry-eyed fixation on scale.
Yeah, I mean, do you think one of the reasons journalists are so obsessed with America is that the stature of journalists in America is so much greater? So it's not just that, I mean, you know, in America, journalism is like sometimes treated in certain circles like a kind of priesthood, you know, sort of the way that people talk about like the Washington Post, Watergate, you know, some of the kind of TV shows, you know, like the West Wing or the Newsroom particularly, you know, journalism is this kind of sacred vocation. You know, journalists are kind of titanic figures who stand for truth and kind of facts, and, you know, sort of they're defeating corruption, they're investigating the dark corners of the world. It's like a, you know, it's like a kind of crusade. And that's never been the way that like British people have seen their journalists, but I think it's where a lot of British journalists would like to be seen. That makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. We have this on the left and on the right. I mean, we have this image of the kind of Fleet Street hack who's drowning in alcohol and battering out his copy.
The hacks.
Late into the night. The hacks, absolutely. And then in the US, they do have these pioneering investigative journalists and these very earnest kind of intellectual commentators, you know, like you said, the New Republic or Commentary or Dissent. They have these kind of grand reputations, whereas it would be hard to be like, the New Statesman, or even, you know, God knows, I hope in the future people will say the Critic in reverent terms.
Yeah, I think but it doesn't have, like, we're not allowed to say anything else in the podcast, that's for sure.
But yeah, I mean, I think we have a slightly grander expectation of American cultural life, and
there's more to it than that, though, I think, because there's a sense in which I think the American journalistic profession always had this very high view of itself, but I think that in the Trump period that took on a new dimension. So, you know, I mean, for example, you get the kind of the Washington Post, it got this tagline, democracy dies in darkness. I mean, do you remember that? You know, that sort of suddenly journalism was no longer just a question of like investigating corruption and being like high-minded defenders of truth. It was also now they were the defenders of the Republic itself. It was only journalists that were standing between Donald Trump and dictatorship. And that's genuinely how an awful lot of quite serious, quite senior centrist figures in American journalism public life presented themselves.
Yeah, that's true. And I mean, the viewing figures and circulation figures went through the roof and then rapidly declined. So maybe that is why we see such a kind of shouty, embattled sense from the likes of, I don't know, a Jolyon Malme figure, for example, where they almost see themselves as holding up British decency and goodness as the weight of the Tories bear down on them. That could be a kind of symptom of Americanization, that's true.
Oh, and who is that? who's that Tory MP who went over to America and took all his goes on about Russia?
Louise Mensch.
Louise Mensch. She came to mind because she's someone who's, you know, not a huge figure in British politics, you know, quit as an MP to move to America. And then when she arrived, she started, you know, engaged with this very kind of self-aggrandizing, quite conspiratorial narratives about like Russian interference in American elections, and, you know, became this hyper kind of hawkish neocon.
That's true. As I was writing in a recent piece for The Critic, some of the worst British people for some reason have found success in the US. Hopefully we can keep our worst people here. No, of course, they're welcome to leave. Welcome, Louise Mensch is welcome to take her talents elsewhere. So I think the lessons we can take from this podcast is, as important as America is, we should perhaps invest quite, well, not quite so much of our interest and enthusiasm in it. And also, instead of romanticizing American journalists and commentators, we should be romanticizing British journalists and commentators much more. And I think I can honestly say that I have no element of self-interest in expressing that thought. Thanks for talking to me.
You're a Byronic figure, Ben. I want to say that, you know, a sort of demigod of journalism for the modern day.
A very ironic figure, very much so, in as much as my self-image and the actual truth are so wildly opposed. But thanks for speaking to me today. Thanks for speaking to me today, right. Sebastian.
Bye, Ben.
Speak to you next week. Thank you for joining us today, everyone.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.